The market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. It's important to remember that, as on the surface, everything looks to be getting a little bit stupid. Consumer-dependent businesses are celebrating record layoffs which are reducing consumer incomes. Seemingly, nobody can afford to buy a home, but across the world, they are getting more expensive, companies are burning trillions of dollars on a market showing little sign of return, and yet despite all of this, the markets keep chugging along. But looking behind the scenes can make it clear that when everything is a crisis, nothing is.
Have an impact on our ability to be able to put affordable homes on the ground. Because right now, that's the biggest issue, is housing affordability.
Oracle has seen his net worth soar by $70 billion in one day.
Debit and credit card spending increased by 2% year over year.
The companies at the center of the AI boom have been busy investing billions of dollars in each other.
The thinking jobs are the ones that are most at risk from artificial intelligence.
If you pay any attention to financial news, you've probably heard the same line every time the stock market has a little whoopsie daisy.
$58 billion wiped off the exchange today.
$136 billion was wiped off.
$5 trillion in value had been wiped from the markets in just 3 weeks.
Yeah, that's right. Every time green line does not go up, we are told some company or the market has lost, destroyed, or wiped out however many billions of dollars. But all right then, where does that money actually go? It might not surprise you to learn that headlines like this are written more for shock and awe than genuine insight. But the simple truth is that the money doesn't actually go anywhere, because it never existed in the first place. Sort of. If you can look beyond the flashy headlines like this and actually understand what they are trying to say, you are going to be much better equipped to make sensible financial decisions when everybody else is busy losing their minds and, if they are lucky enough, maybe even their retirement savings too. This basic understanding has probably actually never been more important than it is right now, because the stock market is breaking new records every single week. Nobody knows if or when the party will stop, but what we do know is that, in this particular case, the money doesn't actually have anywhere else to go.
$5 trillion in value had been wiped from the markets in just 3 weeks.
Gold prices hit a record high on Tuesday.
The dream of owning the house with the white picket fence increasingly giving way to white picket renters.
Could buy a house tomorrow if the price was right, if the interest rates were where they needed to be.
Help for the economy from Washington remains nowhere in sight.
So there are really three different levels of technical explanation for what happens to money during a crash. The good enough for most people level, the armchair market analyst level, and then the level that considers debt, consumption, and all the different asset markets that are getting kind of weird at the moment. Now, most people don't even get level one right, but I promise none of this is as complicated as the financial bros would like you to think. And actually seeing how these markets work is the only way to understand how messed up they really are at the moment. But alright, most of the time when headlines are talking about billions of dollars being destroyed or whatever, what they are really saying is that the market capitalization of a company or group of companies has been repriced. This is just calculated using the number of outstanding shares multiplied by the price the last share was traded at. So for example, Nvidia currently has about 24 billion outstanding shares, and right now those shares are trading at a price of about $170, which gives the company a market cap of $4.1 trillion. If for some reason tomorrow people decided to start trading Nvidia shares at $85, then it would have the market cap of the company and you would inevitably see headlines about Nvidia losing $2 trillion. But they didn't really lose $2 trillion. They were just revalued using this very crude calculation. Now, technically, this could actually help Nvidia's ongoing business operations. Since the AI boom, the company has been doing a lot of share buybacks, where they will use their profits to buy company stock off existing shareholders to take it out of circulation. They are only supposed to do this when management thinks the company is undervalued. So if their stock halves in price, they will get twice as many shares for the same money, which should be a good thing, right? Well, this is assuming, of course, that they aren't just doing stock buybacks to drive up an already hyped up stock. Part of what is making the current stock market so strange at the moment is that by far the biggest net purchaser of shares in these companies are these companies. According to the Fed's Z1 financial accounts, households made net purchases of about $100 billion of stock in 2024. This was dwarfed by listed corporations that did over $625 billion worth of net buying, meaning that companies were buying six times more of their own stock than actual stockholders were. Now, that doesn't seem great, but it's actually worse than it sounds. The whole point of a stock market is that it's supposed to be a place where companies can go and sell their shares to raise money to fund business operations. This net sales figure also includes the company subtracting from this net number by conducting IPOs. The total gross value of stock buybacks was over $1 trillion within 2024 alone. It just so happens that companies also raised about $375 billion in the same year. Now, this has helped to increase market capitalization by driving up share prices, but that's not even the biggest problem. It will actually get more important later on as we go into how asset markets are supposed to function. But for now, for level 1, a market crash is just a readjustment in market capitalization. Unless a company is planning to sell its own stock to raise money to fund future projects, its day-to-day market capitalization shouldn't impact its performance. Market capitalization is kind of like GDP. It's a number that we use a lot because it's sort of easy to calculate, and it's good enough as a rough indication of if things are going in the right direction or not. Now, a lot of people, when they learn this, take it to mean that market cap is irrelevant. A $10 banana is no better than a banana that's on clearance for $5. And while that's true, a sudden price drop on anything can be an indication that there is something rotting away beneath the surface. So, for the next level of understanding, you need to do what the journalists writing the headlines aren't willing to do, and actually follow the money. Now, I know I just said that if a stock halves in value, that doesn't necessarily mean that any money has gone anywhere. But in highly liquid markets, such a scenario can only really happen one way. The NASDAQ doesn't get to slap a 50% off clearance label on Nvidia stock like Walmart does on questionable milk. The way the price moves in these kinds of markets is that if there are more sellers than buyers, the price falls, and if there are more buyers than sellers, the price rises. When people are panic selling stocks, they are still getting money in exchange for their stocks. It may not be as much as they wanted, but what they then do with that money is where things get interesting. Let's say you had some spare money. Yeah, I know, but just pretend with me for a second. With your pile of cash, you have some options. You can invest into the stock market, real estate, bonds, gold, alternatives like cryptocurrency, or you could just hold on to your cash. Alternatively, if you just want to enjoy your life right now, you could spend that money on goods and services like a new car, a bigger house to live in, or a nice vacation. All of these activities that improve your quality of life are generally classified as consumption. Depending on where you and everybody else who has spare money puts their cash, it will increase the value of these markets. So if everybody buys gold, its price will increase as demand increases on an asset with limited supply. Now, stocks, bonds, and real estate are kind of unique because they generate their own cash flow to give money back to you. Stocks do this through dividends, bonds through interest, and real estate through rent. Those cash flows come from other people deciding to put their money into the consumption pile, which becomes revenue for these three asset classes. But all of these other assets really only make returns by having more people buy in at a progressively higher price. When the stock market crashes, what is really happening is everybody trying to grab their cash out of that particular asset market. They do this either because they think the market won't generate as much cash flow in the future, or more often, just to get their cash out before everybody else lowers their price by taking their cash out. Now, if you were lucky enough to get your cash back before everybody else, you have a choice. During a lot of market crashes, people just want to hold on to their cash because they are afraid they will lose their jobs and nothing else is generating cash flow. But eventually, you will need to put your money somewhere. And that predicament is what is creating such a big problem right now. Sure, maybe you think that the stock market might be an AI-fueled bubble, but if you sell your positions, where exactly should you put your money? Gold is at all-time highs, real estate is risky with today's interest rates, cryptocurrency is highly correlated with the stock market, goods and services are more expensive than ever, and people are even starting to question the long-term safety of the bond market. People are quickly running out of safe platforms to stand on, which has got a few people saying that maybe these markets aren't actually broken. Maybe it's the money that's broken. The way that money flows in and out of these markets can have a big impact on the way that you live your life, even if you don't actually have that much in any one of these respective piles. Increasing housing prices have become a defining financial problem of young generations as people can't afford a place to start their own lives or their own families. House prices have outpaced inflation by a lot, which I know is not exactly shocking to most of you, especially if you have watched any of the dozens of videos we have made about the structural problems and broken incentives in the housing market. But the key here is that when we measure price increases relative to inflation, we are only measuring relative to the consumption pile here with the consumer price index. The problem with this is that it doesn't reflect the changing gaps between these other money piles. Real estate, for example, has grown faster than consumer prices, but relative to fixed assets like gold, it's actually gone backwards. An article published by Jonathan Hobbs, a chartered financial analyst, compiled this data to show that if you were paying for the average American house today in gold, you would be spending about half as much as you would have been back in 1991, and roughly a quarter of what you would have been paying in the early 2000s. Now, the article itself used this data to build a case for just buying gold. But the reality is basically any assets would have had the same effect. If you were paying in S&P 500 indexes, the relative fall in house prices would have been even greater. So there are two lessons from this. One is that investing is important. I hope you already knew that. But the deeper lesson here is that it's become much easier for people with lots of money in these piles to buy basically anything they want from these piles. There is only so much money that people can spend on consumption, so wealthy people naturally throw the rest into one of these. As they have grown, they have provided more money to people who own them, and since most of them were already maxing out what they could throw into consumption, they put even more back into these piles, creating a feedback loop of wealth generation. A basic look at the historic numbers makes this pretty clear. Market returns over the past 60 years have averaged just over 10%, and inflation has averaged just over 4%. If you include taxes, this generally means if you can consume less than 4% of your invested assets annually, you can live forever without touching your principal. This basic arithmetic is the foundation of things like the financial independence retire early movement. But for extremely wealthy people who can easily afford to live on less than 4% of their net worth, they can compound wealth faster than they can spend it. Now compare this to most people who earn their income by selling their time. Most wage increases are indexed to consumer prices, if you are lucky, which has been the slowest growing one of these piles. This has made it harder and harder for the wages to compete when both groups want to put their money into the same area. A lot of what the wealthy are buying is different from what working people are buying. But there are some areas where these cross over. Real estate is just the most obvious and socially destabilizing example of that. The reason this is happening now is that the growth in these asset piles has become unprecedented. We have been paying a lot of attention to what the money printer has done to consumer prices, but these other money piles have soaked up much of the excess cash, and it has put non-asset owners further behind. Now, the point of this is not that inequality has become worse. You already knew that. But a new problem coming from that is how these increasingly consolidated markets are behaving. According to the Fed, participation in the stock market is approaching all-time highs, which sounds like a good thing. But this has mainly been driven by lots of people investing very small amounts of money through platforms with low fees and low barriers to entry, like Robinhood. The real money in these asset markets is more consolidated than it has ever been, with the top 10% of households owning 93% of all equities the last time this data was collected at the end of 2024. In a market panic, the reason why people sell their assets is because they want to make sure they have enough cash on hand to cover their most basic consumption needs if they lose their source of income, which for most people is their job. Unfortunately, job losses and market downturns often go hand in hand. However, as these assets have become more consolidated amongst people who can easily cover their living expenses several times over, there have consistently been more people with lots of spare cash to buy in versus the people that need to sell out to cover themselves in a hard time. Put another way, if unemployment was to hypothetically spike tomorrow for any particular reason, most of the people losing their jobs would not have a meaningful pile of assets to sell to cover themselves while they were looking for a new job. And it's not like we would miss the consumers either. A majority of the consumer spending in the economy now comes from the top 10% of households, and corporate profits are primarily driven by selling stuff to other corporations. Sounds pretty bad, right? Well, it gets worse. Remember those record-setting stock buybacks from earlier? Well, they have outnumbered net household share purchases 6-1, adding even more people to the side piling money in. If you add this to the rise of index funds that mindlessly buy and hold a broad selection of shares, it's easy to see how lopsided the market has become. Now, this does not mean that markets can't fall, but what it does mean is that they can stretch far further and stay irrational far longer than they could ever before, and while they do, they are throwing off money like never before for people to buy up every other asset market. Companies have been trying to cut down on workers for as long as those workers have demanded pay and benefits. Whether it's downsizing, outsourcing, streamlining, understaffing, or automating, if there is something a business can do to get rid of workers and their salaries, you better believe they are going to do it. But this time does feel a little bit different. Recent AI advances have been mocked for not quite living up to the bold claims of their tech bro founders. But even in their current imperfect form, LLMs, general use robots, and generative models are already replacing jobs, and they are getting better every day. So that's bad for workers. But if you're a senior corporate executive or company owner, maybe you should be asking yourself, if we automate everybody's job, who is going to buy all of your shit?
A new study out today predicting almost half of all global jobs could be affected by artificial intelligence.
That 40% of all jobs around the world will be impacted by AI.
And found AI could replace 300 million full-time jobs, including positions in the legal and engineering fields.
So far, there are 9 robots here doing the work of more than 250 humans.
I have some good news and some bad news for your theoretical company. The good news is that labor reduction systems of all varieties have already cut out millions of man hours in America alone and made the workers who are left more efficient at their jobs. Artificial intelligence is just another tool that your company can use to get more work out of fewer staff or replace teams entirely. Even here at Little Old Works Media Group, we used to have someone working part-time whose job it was to cut out images on Photoshop to use in our goofy little animations. Now, Adobe Suite has inbuilt AI features which can automatically remove backgrounds from any image with absolutely no human time or skill involved. Now, we love our editors, so we gave him more work editing our history videos. But there are a lot of companies that now don't need to or don't want to employ people for these simple jobs. According to a survey of 697 companies conducted by Metrigy, a research and strategic advisory firm, whatever that means, companies who did not use AI in calendar 2023 hired 89% more agents than those who did use AI in their contact centers. For existing employees, it was even worse. When AI was added to a contact center, 36.8% of companies laid off an average of 26.1% of their employees. These alarming numbers were within just 1 year, and just within call centers, which have already been hit by outsourcing, understaffing, and automation harder than most other professional services. For now. So, congratulations. Your business now has reduced headcount and significantly reduced expenses. But here comes the bad news. In 1914, Henry Ford doubled the salary of his factory workers to $5 per day. The story goes he did this because he wanted all of his employees to be able to afford a Ford Model T of their own, boosting company revenue. Now, this is basically complete nonsense. In reality, Ford just wanted to reduce staff turnover and deny talent to up-and-coming car companies like Dodge to maintain his monopoly over the growing automobile industry. But as with every good fairy tale, there is a nugget of truth in there. If the employment rate suddenly drops as hard as it did in the call centers from the study in every company around the world, then companies will undeniably struggle with reduced revenue as people without jobs don't have the buying power they once did, and even people with jobs will cut back out of fear that they might be next. But there is a business plan that you, as a hypothetical titan of industry, might want to consider so that this isn't a problem. And that's just making stuff exclusively for other wealthy business owners while diverting resources away from people who have nothing to offer you that can't be done more efficiently by a machine or a cheaper worker on the other side of the world. Now, if you think that sounds a bit crazy, you should know that it's already kind of happening. And the best place to see it is in video games. Yes, those occasionally fun distractions from real life are the perfect example of the shift happening in the real world right now. So let me cook. According to Grandview Research, the video game industry is now bigger than the movie, music, and television industries combined, and it has honed in its most profitable strategy. Free-to-play games are ironically some of the most profitable games on the market, because they have perfected a business strategy called freemium pricing. Most people will play their games for free, but a select few, affectionately known in the industry as whales, will spend thousands, sometimes even millions of dollars on a single game to unlock in-game perks that would be almost impossible to obtain as a free user. It's important that these games still have free users though, because without them, the whales would have nobody to show off to or pwn with their paid-for advantages. In a world where people are looking for budget-friendly forms of entertainment, the game industry has realized that the best way to turn a profit is to cater to those who have the financial means, or at the very least, the credit limit, to spend ridiculous amounts of money on a video game. The people who have the most financial means don't work for their money. They own income-producing assets. And if automation does replace jobs on an even more widespread scale, that will make your ability to work less valuable and simultaneously income-producing assets more valuable. The rate of change in AI and automation makes the future impossible to predict. But if the people investing in these technologies want to see a financial return on that investment, they are going to learn what the game industry already has. There is more money to be made by catering to other rich people, and everybody else can be kept around as entertainment. Now, if you think that sounds a bit depressing, well, welcome to this channel. But also, I should tell you that market trends already say this is happening. AI isn't going to change your world. It's just going to continue a trend that's already been happening for years now. In the 1992 movie Glengarry Glen Ross, the iconic Always Be Closing scene has Alec Baldwin's character bragging to another salesman about driving an $80,000 BMW. adjusted for $1992, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that would be the equivalent of just under $182,000 today. That is a very expensive automobile, to be sure. But these days, if you drive around a major city, you're likely to see dozens of cars that cost that much or more, and they probably wouldn't even stand out that much. According to company sales data and historic records, Lamborghini has sold more cars in the last 10 years alone than it did in all the rest of the company's history combined, because there is simply a bigger market for $300,000 cars than ever before. The same general trend is true for other extreme luxury brands like Bentley, Ferrari, Patek Philippe, luxury groceries at Erewhon, gym memberships that cost more than rent, hotels that make Hilton look like a Holiday Inn, and to top it off, private jets are all now way more popular than they ever have been. One thing that often gets lost in discussions of wealth inequality is that, yes, billionaires are getting richer. But there are also far more rich people around than ever before, and it's because the value of an hour of human labor has stayed more or less stagnant, while the value of an asset and the availability of credit has skyrocketed. People who held onto an even modest portfolio over the last 4 years now have enormous fortunes. Certain individuals got incredibly lucky with good investments, and other people accessed easy credit to get absolutely jacked to the tits on leverage and ride the longest asset bull run in history. Very few people have made modern fortunes through work alone. And you might have even noticed how investing went from something that you should do to secure your retirement to something you need to do to have any quality of life at all. If robots really do take over, then it will just continue to push the value of an hour of human work down, because it could be done by a machine instead. And it will rally the value of assets because business owners and investors will benefit from the free labor substitute. This is where people point to policy fixes like a universal basic income. If you haven't heard about this idea by now, that's impressive. But it's basically a government payment made to everybody, regardless of personal financial conditions, that should be enough to cover basic living expenses. It's been proposed as a solution to keep the whole system going if people can't earn an income for themselves because their labor has been outsourced or automated. But that is still not a desirable outcome for anybody. If comprehensive automation of human labor gets as far as needing this, then you will fall into one of two defined classes of people. You will either be getting by based on a government lifeline, or you will be in the class of people that own the businesses complaining about all the taxes they need to pay to fund that lifeline. I find it a little bit easier to sympathize with one of those groups. But there are still no winners. Just last week, the results of one of the most comprehensive universal basic income experiments was published. The research gave 1,000 people living in Texas and Illinois $1,000 a month with no conditions attached. To qualify for this study, their 2019 household income had to be less than 300% of the federal poverty line, or $37,470 for an individual. There was also an unlucky control group of 2,000 people who were only given $50 a month. This is because when your personal finances are being studied, you are more likely to be careful about your spending decisions, and the researchers wanted to control for these changes. The study itself was funded by an organization called Open Research, which is not technically affiliated with OpenAI. But they are both managed by Sam Altman, who has been very vocal about how this technology could displace billions of jobs. Now, if you ever find yourself running an AI startup that burns millions of dollars a day, then one of the best ways to ensure that you keep that investor money coming is to pretend to be really scared about how your technology is going to replace workers. Because, well, replacing workers is really exciting to investors. So realistically, this study was probably little more than a marketing stunt conducted by one of the best funded organizations in the space. But that doesn't mean that the results aren't still interesting. The key results related to employment was that the group that received the $1,000 payment ended up earning significantly less for themselves than the control group. After the payment was accounted for, they still earned more. But $12,000 alone is not enough to live anywhere in America without other forms of support. All households ended up earning more, but that was largely because this experiment started right at the beginning of COVID, when employment, particularly in low-wage professions, was hurt by lockdowns. The reason the researchers gave as to why households receiving the subsidy ended up earning less money for themselves was because many people took it as an opportunity to cut down on how much they were working and commit more time to leisure and looking after their family. This fits the optimistic idea of an AI future where we can have machines do everything for us while we just relax and collect universal basic income. But the findings still told a story of people who were financially struggling. Mental health improved because people were less stressed, but those improvements faded by the end of the first year. Food security also increased, but again only in the first year, as even people with additional income fell victim to rising living expenses, and that was when they could work to earn additional money. When compared to being plunged into poverty, it's an okay compromise. But this isn't going to happen overnight. Outsourcing turned entire cities in America into ghost towns, but it happened so slowly that big changes like this never got addressed. The endgame for people investing in automation is to build that automated utopian future. The endgame for everyone else is to make sure that they aren't excluded from it. Late last week, everybody's least favorite tech priest T-Rex, Sam Altman, said the quiet part out loud when he suggested that AI and the industry surrounding it might be in a bit of a bubble. This simultaneously shocked absolutely everyone and absolutely nobody at the same time. The value of the entire stock market has nearly doubled over the last 5 years. This has been driven almost entirely by just 10 companies, whose growth was in turn driven almost entirely by the promise of AI. Most people understand that this isn't sustainable, but they also understand that technology like this has changed the world before. Improvements are slowing down as new models are showing disappointing improvements, but every day we are discovering new things we can do with these products. For every argument, there is a counterargument. You don't need to watch another video speculating about the future of AI, because the truth is nobody has a damn clue. But what we can do is look back over these last 3 years and find out how much this whole game has cost us, because the numbers are not good.
It's almost like investors are saying $100 million isn't enough, Deirdre, make it two.
And we're told that Zuckerberg at that time really said, okay,
I'm thrilled we get to do this in the United States of America. I think this will be the most important project of this era.
The dormant nuclear reactors at Three Mile Island, because decades after a partial reactor meltdown shut down part of the facility.
Okay, so everybody has been paying a lot of attention to the astronomical valuations that have been assigned to everything, even partially AI related. And they have also been paying attention to billions of dollars in value vanishing into thin air whenever Jensen Huang sneezes the wrong way. Now, to be fair, we kind of have to pay attention to it, because that's all of our retirement savings tied up in this fun little game. But all of this value probably means a lot less than you think. Market capitalization, which is what most AI headlines focus on, is simply a calculation of how many shares are in circulation multiplied by what number the last speculator in line made a trade at. If Nvidia halves in value, that doesn't mean that $2 trillion has been destroyed. It just means we have put a new price tag on what this business does. Just like if Walmart marks down a banana from $10 to $5, it hasn't destroyed $5. The actual numbers we should be paying attention to are the actual resources that we have put into this system versus what we have gotten back out. And by resources, you can't just think of cash. Cash is really just the receipt for resources. So while dollars are a great unit to tally everything up, what we should instead be keeping track of is how many cold, hard, tangible, Age of Empire style resources we have used to fuel this one particular tech tree. Because only then can we find out if this is really making the world a richer place. Alright, so how do we do that? Well, we can start from a simple analysis of the direct business expenses taken on by companies desperate to stay ahead of their competitors. And after that, we can work down to the less tangible stuff, like the opportunity cost of sanctioning China over AI chips or dedicating some of the world's best researchers to producing whatever the hell this is. The first major resource being used to fuel this machine is the most obvious one, all of those chips. In our Amazon video released just a month ago, the tally for AI capital expenditure amongst just four of the top tech companies had reached $200 billion for the year and $60 billion for the most recent reported quarter alone. But since that video went live, new filings have come out, and now, according to company reports collated by Bloomberg, spending for this year is already on track to hit $344 billion. That is more than 1% of America's entire GDP being used building compute infrastructure to develop and operate new models. Now, if this sounds just a little bit dumb to you, don't worry. It's actually worse than you think. For one thing, this number only includes the top four tracked public firms: Meta, Google, Microsoft, and the biggest spender of all, Amazon. Smaller businesses or private companies like OpenAI are not included in these numbers because they don't have to release financial information. But from the outside, we can still make some educated guesses. The scale and frequency of fundraising taking place at OpenAI, the makers of ChatGPT, is growing exponentially every year, even as they have started squeezing out revenue. In March this year, the company received $40 billion from investors in the largest private tech deal in history. And then, just 4 months later, they raised another $8.3 billion. Every time they do this, their existing investors are giving up some of their stake in the company. So the only reason they would go ahead with it is if they really needed the money, which they do, mostly to keep on building new compute capacity. The second reason this spending is probably even worse than it looks has a lot to do with accounting. Capital expenditure just means businesses spending money on fixed assets like land, vehicles, and in this instance, gigantic data centers. For the accountants, this distinction is important, because if a company makes $1 million in gross profit and then spends $1 million buying a building, it doesn't get to subtract the total purchase from its revenue up front like it would if it spent $1 million on a regular expense like salaries. Instead, they have to use a depreciation schedule, which accounts for how much value an item loses with every year of use in line with industry standards. For server equipment, that is 5 years. Which means if a company spent $1 million on a fancy new rack of NVIDIA GPUs, they would only be able to claim $200,000 a year as actual expenses against their taxes. Normally, companies want to maximize this appreciation to minimize their tax liability, artificially making things look worse in the business than they actually are, as far as the IRS is concerned. But right now, they are kind of doing the opposite. Chips that were state-of-the-art in 2022, when ChatGPT first launched, are almost completely useless in today's modern AI data centers and are largely not even worth the energy to run. It's highly unlikely that the billions of dollars in chips that they are buying right now are going to take 5 years to fully depreciate, even though that is what it's going to say on their official financial statements. This treadmill of technology has created a higher level of spending than any other project in history. And what is easy to forget with all of these insane numbers being thrown around is that these are resources that could have been used elsewhere. One way that you could interpret these numbers is that the rapidly escalating AI arms race has become an incredibly efficient machine that turns investor dollars into e-waste with a byproduct of brain rot. But maybe we are getting ahead of ourselves. So far, total spending on just this technical hardware alone has amounted to around $1 trillion by just these four companies. According to data from Stanford, Chinese state-owned enterprises have invested an additional $500 billion into AI infrastructure. And then, every other organization in the world that isn't Amazon, Meta, Google, or Microsoft has dropped in another $500 trillion working backwards off the sales data from NVIDIA and AMD. But that's just the first item on the budget sheet. And these companies are finding out the hardware is the cheap part. The costs of getting AI to where it is now have already been staggering. But when you do a cost-benefit analysis, it's also important to look at, well, the benefits. The only problem is, those benefits have been surprisingly hard to find. A report by MIT tracked 300 companies implementing generative AI into their workflows on an enterprise level. Despite an additional $30 to $40 billion of investment, which we can add to the tally, the study found that 95% of the organizations generated zero returns from AI. Now, for what it's worth, I would like to say that I don't want to completely write off AI, even though I know it's sometimes really easy to hate on how it's being sold to the world. AI, like most new technologies, is coming along with a bit too much hype, but underneath that, there are some cool things you can do with it. I know I have used this example before, but even here at Little Ol' Works Media Group, we used to spend hours every week cutting out images to use as assets in our videos. Now, most of that can be done with AI tools letting our editors actually work on something creative, or you know, just getting some time to go out and touch grass. These are real practical tools that have helped make someone's working day easier, more productive, and less monotonous. The problem with this, though, is that when companies, governments, and non-profit organizations have poured trillions of dollars into developing this technology, useful practical tools are not good enough. Companies want to be able to replace their workforce, not make their work slightly easier. Governments want a superintelligence, not something that can trim out JPEGs. And honestly, I don't even want to know what someone like Peter Thiel wants.
You would prefer the human race to endure, right? You're hesitating.
Yeah, well,
Yes?
I don't know. I would... Yes.
Okay.
But
whatever these grand ambitions end up being, the bill is adding up. And we haven't even got to the big expense yet. Energy. Earlier this month, a group of AI researchers started making headlines after they returned from a tour of facilities in China. Their claim was that America had probably already lost the AI arms race. Not because China had better technology or researchers, but because they had an actual functional electric grid. According to the Department of Energy in a report, the foundation of America's electrical grids were built in the 1960s and 70s, and a lot of the infrastructure is still being used today, well past the end of its intended life cycle. China has industrialized much more recently than we have here in America, so while our grid is barely holding on, they have had the advantage of practically building theirs from scratch with more modern technology. Now, this still hasn't been cheap for them, but since the 1990s, while America's economy has been primarily fueled by consumer spending, China's has grown on exports and construction. According to their national statistics and corroborated by Bloomberg Intelligence, the country spent nearly $2.3 trillion on infrastructure in 2022 alone, compared to $1.1 trillion worth of spending in the US, spread out over 5 years. This is not to say what China is doing is a good idea either. This kind of spending has put them in a potentially ruinous amount of debt. But the reason this is important for the AI discussion is because Chinese grids frequently run with energy reserve margins of 100%, which means it has twice the energy capacity it needs, whereas in America, we operate with margins of just 15%, according to the researchers who made this report. That means that AI data centers in China are actually a useful way to soak up extra energy capacity, while the same facilities here in America are a strain on already crumbling infrastructure. The International Energy Agency estimates that data centers accounted for 1.5% of the world's electricity consumption in 2024, and is projected to double by 2030 if current trends continue with AI. If you were to get that out of your outlet at home, 450 terawatt hours spread out over the last 3 years only would have cost you around $18 billion, assuming you were able to negotiate wholesale rates of about $40 per megawatt hour. That's actually not bad, but it's far from the whole story. That's just the cost that the AI operators will pay, not everybody else. You've probably noticed that your electricity has become more expensive over recent months. Or maybe you haven't because, let's be honest, everything has become more expensive over recent months. But anyway, I want to play a little game. This is average energy prices across American cities according to the BLS. Can you see anything that stands out? Let me give you a hint. Major AI development really kicked off right here. Now, the war in Ukraine, more EVs, and overall inflation played a part in this too. But here in America, we never really relied on Russian energy. Before the recent surge in AI, electricity prices were actually declining compared to inflation. But now they have almost doubled within the last 3 years alone. This is costing us all in more ways than just the big, beautiful energy bills we have to deal with every month. Other industries like manufacturing also use a lot of energy, and if they have to pay twice as much for this crucial input, they are going to pass those costs along to all of us and be less competitive in global markets. According to the Energy Information Administration, end-use electricity expenditures totaled $419 billion in 2021 before this jump. They have not published data on 2024 yet, but if we are using more electricity and paying almost twice as much for it, the actual cost felt across the economy is easily an additional $400 billion. Again, this is just in America. Now, some of the largest AI players have responded to these market conditions by just commissioning their own power plants. But other businesses are pursuing a more tried and tested approach, begging the government to fix their problems for them. Big tech companies have been lobbying hard to get money allocated to upgrade energy infrastructure. They are using the threat of moving their operations offshore if their needs aren't met, which is an effective message since the government sees this as such a strategic industry. Now, if we end up getting a better electrical grid because some big tech companies wanted it, maybe that might actually be an example of political lobbying accidentally doing some good. But according to the University of Texas Energy Institute report, this could take trillions of dollars and nobody is arguing that the grid doesn't need an upgrade. The problem is that nobody else is getting a say as to whether there are better places to be spending that money first. Affordable housing has become the defining challenge of this generation, not only in America, but across the world. House prices have grown so much faster than wages that young people will struggle for years just to save for a down payment. Also, they can struggle for decades to make the repayments on their mortgage. At the same time, we are told that our home is our biggest asset. And the last time the real estate market saw a significant dip, it took the global economy down with it. So, can we make houses affordable without destroying the economy?
I know the cost of housing is so important to you.
We want home ownership to be a reality.
We introduced a new incentive program to help first-time homebuyers get into the market.
According to data from the U.S. Census Bureau, the home ownership rate in America is 65%. So the majority of people have a direct financial interest in not seeing their biggest financial asset lose its value. This is in spite of the fact that according to a study by the Cato Institute, 87% of Americans are worried about the cost of housing, which means there is a big overlap between people who want affordable housing, as long as it's not theirs. This means that the only winning course of action for politicians is to performatively make the problem worse. The Biden administration has announced plans to offer tax credits of up to $10,000 to families selling their home to another owner-occupant, in addition to another tax credit of up to $5,000 to offset mortgage rates for first-time homebuyers. These could be used in conjunction with a $25,000 bonus for first-generation homebuyers. But if you are a new buyer and get $40,000 worth of extra tax bonuses and grants, all that will do is make affordable housing $40,000 more expensive, which doesn't really make you any better off overall. It is great for existing property owners, though. This has been tried in other countries like Australia and Canada, and it did not work as a long-term solution, although it did allow for Richard to Airbnb his basement and use the proceeds to buy a McLaren. In fact, their real estate market is even more fucked than ours. Presumably, the only reason Patrick Boyle has filmed all of his videos in random offices and classrooms is because he couldn't afford the rent on his flat in London on his modest income as a hedge fund manager. Most policies that aim to give more purchasing power to new buyers really only benefit existing owners, even if it does let politicians score some easy points in the short term. So, if you can't make houses more affordable by increasing people's buying power, then the only option left is to make houses more affordable by lowering their prices. This sounds simple, but it can cause some big problems. If house prices collapse too quickly, it can leave people underwater on their home loans, where the money they owe to the bank is worth more than the house itself. This can destabilize the financial system and the economy that depends on it, because it makes lending highly risky if debt can't be secured against real assets and some people choose to just walk away from their homes. This can have knock-on effects that will impact every aspect of your financial life. The people who will be hurt most by a housing crash are people who have only just purchased their first home and still have a large mortgage on it, since they have the smallest equity buffer before their mortgage is worth more than their house. People who have owned their home for a long time and have a small or no mortgage won't be hurt and might even just enjoy the lower property taxes. Sacrificing the people on the bottom rung of the housing ladder to let more people grab on isn't a good idea, and it weirdly doesn't even make houses affordable. This was the situation for many American households in 2008. Even though house prices in some areas more than halved, the actual rate of home ownership over that time also fell significantly. So, just making houses cheaper isn't enough to make houses more affordable, unless you look at some radical and not so radical solutions that won't be politically popular, but just might work. There are solutions that could actually make houses cheaper and keep them cheaper, and the political will to take these drastic steps is growing every day. You see, this chart here doesn't tell the full story. The spike here wasn't a bunch of new people buying a home and then selling it again. It was mostly young people moving back in with their parents at the start of the pandemic. This chart only measures the percentage of Americans that live in an owner-occupied home. It doesn't account for if they actually own it. According to data collected from the U.S. Census Bureau and compiled by USA Facts, the number of people aged between 25 and 34 still living at home with their parents peaked to an all-time high in 2020 and has remained near historic highs. Most young adults in this age group would prefer a place of their own. But house prices and rent have made it financially challenging for most and outright impossible for many. So, we might soon have enough people to start demanding more drastic steps. One solution that has gained a lot of attention in recent years is a land value tax that, as the name suggests, would charge property owners on the value of their land, but not on the value of the property as a whole. A land value tax doesn't consider the value of buildings and improvements on top of the land. It just accounts for the value of the land itself and charges whoever owns that land a percentage of its value every year, just like you pay a percentage of your income every year. There are details to be hammered out over exactly how much that percentage should be and if it should be progressive like income taxes. For example, someone that owns their family home on a lot worth $500,000 might have to pay 1% or $5,000 every year in a land value tax. But a wealthy landlord that owns 50 single-family homes that are collectively worth $25 million might have to pay a 4% rate or $1 million every year. With the right fine-tuning, this system, which was first popularized by economist Henry George, promises to fix a lot of society's problems, including housing. In his most famous book, Progress and Poverty, George argued that a land value tax could be a country's only tax if it was managed well enough. The name of the book sounds about as depressing as your average How Money Works video. But it became so popular in the late 19th century that an entire political movement grew up around it, today known simply as Georgism. Supporters of Georgism make some big promises. But for now, you only need to focus on one aspect, which is that it should make housing more affordable. Adding a tax to something to make it more affordable might be a little bit counterintuitive. But if landowners have to pay a portion of their land's value every year in tax, they have a strong incentive to maximize returns on that land or otherwise sell it to someone who could. The land value tax on a completely empty lot should theoretically be the same as the land value tax on a lot next door that has a 50-unit apartment building on it collecting 50 sets of rent. The owner of the vacant lot is motivated to either sell their land or build something on it to generate income to offset the tax that they are paying to own the land because they pay the same tax no matter what. This could act as a way to discourage vast land holding purely for capital appreciation, because it makes it a lot less profitable to sit and hold onto empty real estate. A broad land value tax could also offset income taxes, which means regular working people will have more disposable income to put towards buying houses. Traditional Georgism actually argued that a land value tax could replace income taxes entirely. But even if you don't believe that is possible, it would still help. If the average house is worth $1 million, that is not actually a problem if the average worker is making $250,000. But in reality, house prices have massively outpaced increases in wages since the 1970s. A land value tax could rebalance this in three ways. The first way is by reducing income taxes, since the government would get an alternative source of revenue. It's up to you to decide if they would really pass that along, though. The second way is by making real estate a less attractive buy and hold investment, pushing more supply onto the market by getting people to actually do something with their land instead of treating it like a buy and hold investment. The third way it could close this widening gap is to encourage people to invest into actual businesses that make stuff and employ people rather than buying and holding land. More business investment instead of more real estate speculation should increase worker productivity and, by extension, wages, closing the gap between income and house prices. Perhaps the best part of all of this is that it can be done slowly, so that house prices don't collapse overnight, which would just make things worse for regular people. The challenge with this is political. People don't like taxes, and without sitting everyone down and forcing them to read the work of Henry George, you are going to struggle to sell this to voters when big landowners can easily lobby against it by talking about poor hardworking farmers and retirees that are going to be forced out of their home by another tax. The moral justification of a land value tax is that a country belongs to its people, and if you specifically want the exclusive use of a bit of that country as your own private property, you owe a little bit of rent to everybody else in the country for using land that belongs to them. It makes sense, but it's not going to be politically popular. It is also more government interference in the free market, thumbing the scale in favor of one type of investor over another. But that's actually the point. Even if widespread land value tax is never going to happen, at the very least, taxes that currently favor real estate over business investment should entirely be scrapped. Real estate-specific government perks like 1031 exchanges, reduced capital gains, opportunity zones, negative gearing, pass-throughs, deferments, deductions, tax credits, home buyers' plans, government-backed mortgages, and home office write-offs are all kind of like a negative land tax, which shifts government incentives in favor of hoarding as much land as possible. With this many perks, you shouldn't really be surprised that people buy real estate as an investment. The other weakness of a land value tax is that it assumes that people with land holdings wouldn't already be building housing on them to maximize their rental income if they could. But they can't. So, the second solution to making houses more affordable without destroying the economy is simply to build more houses. Zoning, NIMBYism, HOAs, a long list of confusing codes, and a lack of skilled tradesmen has made building a home a major ordeal. The sign of a successful economy is that it can produce things like a computer, a car, or a house efficiently and for a competitive price. We have convinced ourselves that houses are somehow special, and that them being limited and expensive is a positive characteristic. According to census data, America is building fewer houses today than we were in the 1970s, even though our population has almost doubled. Building houses does more than just increase the supply of an essential commodity. It also gives lots of jobs to lots of people, because building homes and the utilities that support them require real hands-on work. Now, just building more houses won't solve all of our problems. American cities have a major problem with urban sprawl. Building a house an hour away from a city center with no public transport or local amenities just replaces one problem with another. But we can fix this by building medium-density housing for people who just want a decent place to live. People are pro new medium-density home construction nationally, but are anti-construction locally. According to a survey conducted by the US Census Bureau, home equity is simply considered as most households' most significant asset, so most people don't want housing supplies diluted, especially in their local area with cheaper alternatives. I don't think I really need to convince you that building more houses to fix a housing shortage is an important step, but it probably won't be enough by itself. China has built more houses than any other country on the planet in the last 20 years, and they have homes that are even more unaffordable than ours. Yes, they have a lot of people, but their building spree more than made up for this. China built so many new homes that thousands of new developments and millions of apartments are sitting empty in so-called ghost cities that exist just for people to own a home. In China, a home is not just people's biggest investment. It's their only investment. According to an analysis by JP Morgan's private banking division, Chinese real estate was the single largest asset class in the world as of 2021. And that's exactly the problem. It was a financial asset first, and a place for people to live second. A lot of the housing constructed in China in the last 20 years you couldn't even live in. It was an empty concrete box with no utilities and a tower with no people. It was a financial asset in the world's biggest filing cabinet. But learning from those mistakes can show us the third way to make housing affordable without destroying the economy. China is experiencing a significant slowdown because of how much emphasis they put on real estate as a financial asset. But here in America, we are making the same mistakes. Companies are turning family homes into financial assets that can be bundled up and traded on securities markets like stocks, bonds, or options. According to data from Redfin, investors purchased more than a quarter of affordable homes sold in America last quarter, which was an all-time high. Investors include anybody from someone purchasing their first investment property all the way up to Invitation Homes buying their 100,000th home. The number of single-family homes owned by large corporate investors is still less than 2% of total housing stock and a small share of home purchases. But before COVID, it was less than 1%. Whatever the investor looks like, real estate has become too attractive as a financial asset because rents are high and the government has demonstrated that they won't let prices fall, precisely because the real estate market has become too big to fail. Definancializing real estate could be as simple as an outright ban on corporate ownership of family homes. If my community polls are an indicator of national sentiment, it's one of the first solutions that would be politically popular. Just reining in lending could also put the brakes on property investors who see real estate as a way to leverage their way into an overnight fortune by extracting rent rather than investing in something productive. To be fair, the financial system is just as guilty. If you want to take out a 5-to-1 leverage position to start a business that will employ people, a bank would laugh you out of a branch. But ask for a 50-to-1 leverage position on a home and you will have financial firms fighting for your business. How much worse can home prices possibly get? The median age of a first-time homebuyer is now approaching 40, not even accounting for the people who will never buy a house. 1% down mortgages are becoming increasingly common, and so too are 40-year terms. The median family now needs to spend almost 40% of their income to cover the median loan repayment, and that's before counting income taxes and other expenses like insurance, property tax, and maintenance. In certain cities, this number is over 90%. Which effectively just means that the average family cannot afford the average home. For most people, the only feasible way to buy a house is to have just sold a house, with first-time buyers now representing the smallest share of the market since economists started collecting this data over 4 decades ago. The numbers are not great, but at least they seem to suggest that affordability can't get any worse, right? Well, I hate to break it to you, but there are a lot of emerging factors that could make home prices much, much worse.
More than 3 years since graduating from college, 25-year-old Zoe Zarenda is back in her childhood bedroom in Connecticut.
40% of those in multi-generational homes cite financials as the reason for cohabitating.
But the bank of mom and dad is playing a bigger role in buying houses.
It's becoming difficult as major insurance companies pull some of their coverage options.
It means I have to work extremely hard to be able to afford a nice house one day.
Now, before we get into crushing your hopes and dreams, there is some good news to get out of the way first. The median sales price of a household in America over the last 3 years has actually trended downwards from its all-time peak in 2022. Now, a lot of people will point to this as an early sign that building initiatives and affordable housing policies are starting to work. However, while this chart looks like it could be heading in the right direction, there are some things that you should know about the data it is presenting. Median sales price can only track the homes that actually get sold, which is still down significantly. According to the National Association of Realtors, there are now almost 25% fewer houses trading hands every month than there were before the pandemic, and almost 40% fewer than there were just 4 years ago. Now, you probably already know some of the reasons behind this. people who were able to lock in sub 3% mortgage rates 4 years ago are simply not willing to sell their homes even if they move to a completely different city. They would rather rent out their existing home to someone else while they go and rent a house themselves. This trend has actually been even more important in other markets, so remember it for later. This number also depends a lot on the type of houses that have been selling. The reality is that the people who have been forced to sell their home are more often than not those on lower incomes, and simultaneously, the only homes that buyers can afford are more likely to be budget-friendly starter homes. The Case-Shiller Home Price Index, which accounts for these variables, still shows that home prices are increasing pretty consistently year on year. But even with that nuance around the actual data, there are levels to this game. Even with all of the problems that the American housing market is causing for society, we actually have it pretty good compared to almost every other country on Earth, according to the numbers anyway. There are probably already some Canadians and Australians in the comment section telling us that we have no idea how bad it can get. There is probably also someone from London telling them that they have no idea how bad it can get. But what most of them probably don't realize is that there is a level of housing unaffordability even beyond this that honestly puts the rest of us to shame. In the hierarchy of housing crises, we are still on level 1. So then, what would it take for us to step up our game, so to speak? Well, the first level above us would be cities in places like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and certain high-income parts of Europe. Across America, our average house price to income ratio is 3.4. This is simply a street calculation of how many years of the average household after tax income you would need to earn to buy the average house. It's not a perfect measure, but we will get into the problems with it soon. But as a starting point of comparison, the UK has a ratio of 8.7, Australia 8.4, and Canada 9.5. If our real estate market started to look like these places, then the average home price could easily double or triple from where they are now. So the obvious question is, how is that even possible? Well, there are four big differences, so let's go through them from least to most concerning. The first difference is that this data adjusts for home sizes and scales all homes to 90 square meters, which is the equivalent of roughly 970 square feet. Per square foot, our homes are significantly cheaper. But instead of making them more affordable, or just constructing them out of something other than chalk, popsicle sticks, and hot glue, we have instead chosen to just make them bigger. Now, this is made worse by the fact that we generally do not share our households nearly as much as people do in other countries, although that is starting to change out of necessity. But I am getting ahead of myself. Either way, it's not exactly fair to compare $500,000 7-bedroom McMansion to a $500,000 studio apartment, even if this trend has caused other problems like urban sprawl, huge transport costs, and more expensive utilities and maintenance. But even accounting for home sizes, that still doesn't explain the whole difference. If by some miracle we were willing to actually give up our third guest bedrooms, house prices still have a lot of headroom to rise much higher than they are today if we are not extremely careful around some major issues. So one other thing that we have going for us that has kept our real estate market in check, if you could really call it that, is that we are actually pretty good at spreading out. Now that doesn't just include the car-centric urban sprawl that we have become famous for. Sure, our cities are generally more spread out than our friends in the old world. But we are also more spread out between these cities as well. Demographers use something called urban primacy, which is a rough indication of how concentrated a population is within a single city. All it does is measure what percent of the country's entire population lives within a single center. Here in the US, about 7% of our people live in the New York metropolitan area. Now, that's still a lot of people, but when compared to most other high-income countries, even those with more space than us, it's actually incredibly low, indicating that we haven't put all of our real estate eggs in one speculative basket. Now, this is actually even more significant than it looks, because we have a lot of decent runners-up. You could add together our 10 largest cities combined, and it would still account for less than a quarter of our population. A small caveat is that we are actually so good at spreading out that this data is open to some interpretation, because it is difficult to know exactly where to draw statistical borders around population centers. Either way, if we compare our urban primacy to a country like Australia, we are already significantly more diversified. But if we include the second largest city in this calculation, then almost half of their population lives in just Sydney and Melbourne. This urban concentration drives prices in more ways than you might expect. Firstly, of course, if everybody is fighting over space in just one or two cities, there is less supply and more demand for small areas of space, even if the rest of the country is very large. But less intuitively, it also creates the same problem we are seeing in the stock market right now. If just a few centers dominate everything else, then they attract most of the investment and get most of the opportunities. In cities like London, Sydney, Auckland, and Vancouver, this has created a trend where people will live and work in big cities with jobs and opportunities. But since they won't be able to afford a house there, they will use their higher earnings to buy a house in a different city and rent it out. This rent vesting strategy is becoming far more common back here in America, thanks to people who tried to move out of major centers during the pandemic, but now don't want to sell their homes because of those low locked-in interest rates. This has basically let us outsource the housing crisis into a lot of cities where people don't earn enough to compete with the few centers that are driving the most growth. These other countries have had a big head start, but we are heading in exactly the same direction. A report by the Bureau of Economic Analysis found that as of 2024, just 31 counties accounted for more than one-third of the country's entire economic output. This statistic has only been getting more concentrated, as certain industries like finance and tech have become increasingly dominant, while other industries have seen continual declines. Now, there was a really nice chart prepared in the Bureau's report showing this, but their site has gone offline during the government shutdown, so, for now, you are just going to have to trust me, bro. Anyway, as job opportunities continue to consolidate, we are already seeing house prices in certain cities outpace the already elevated prices everywhere else. For a property roughly the size of a two-bedroom apartment, the most unaffordable city in America is New York, where average prices are 12 times average disposable incomes. This is close to what we see in cities like Sydney and Vancouver. They are slightly less affordable, but the difference is a lot smaller. The problem is, this basically means that in these countries, half of their people deal with housing affordability problems that are just as bad as New York. For now, we at least have the luxury of alternatives. But if industries continue to consolidate, more and more of us are going to have to make the same decisions, picking between a place where we can afford to live and picking a place where we can get a decent job. But it gets worse. A two-bedroom residence in Sydney costs 12.5 times the city's average household disposable income. In Beijing, Shanghai, Taipei, and Colombo, that ratio is approaching 40 times. Someone would need to dedicate more than 30 years of their entire take-home income to afford a home that would be considered extremely small by our standards. These cities are often ignored in the usual lists talking about the most unaffordable places to live, because they are not in the OECD, and their outright prices are not quite as high. But they still show that we are not even approaching the limits of how bad the housing market could get. Property in these cities are almost as expensive as similar properties in major American cities, but the average wages are significantly lower. So, how do these people afford it? Well, their homes are, on average, much smaller. According to data compiled by respective housing departments, the average American has approximately 900 square feet of space per person in their homes. In cities like Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Seoul, the numbers are between 170 and 300 square feet per person. People afford these homes by banding together savings from multiple generations and then living in cramped conditions, often while paying off extremely large mortgages. Now, if you are thinking it, then yes, you are right. Culturally, multi-generational housing is much more common in these countries. However, when people are living in a two-bedroom apartment with eight other people from three generations, they are doing it out of necessity rather than tradition. Now, I want to make two things clear. The first is that, to be fair, we are a long way from this kind of situation, for now. But the second is that it's pretty dangerous to assume that the unaffordable housing problem has a natural limit. If we aren't very proactive with policies around home construction, responsible lending, and new development, there is nothing to stop us trending in the same direction. In fact, we kind of already are. For the first time in over 160 years, the number of people living in the average American household actually went up, despite declining birth rates, simply because more generations were living in the same home. At the same time, in more than 50 years, average houses started to get smaller. Now, I would love to conclude that we are all simultaneously getting closer to our families and more environmentally conscious at the same time. But let's be honest with ourselves. We are doing this because we have to.